கொஞ்சவியாழி கௌபி ஜனவல்லவா கிரிவரதாரி கௌபி ஜனவல்லவா கிரிவரதாரி சௌதநந்தன வஜ ஜனராஞ்சன சௌதநந்தன வஜ ஜனராஞ்சன ஜமுனதீராவனச்சாரி ஜமுனதீரா வனச்சாரி ஜய ராதா மாதவ குஞ்சவிஹாரி ஜய ராதா மாதவ குஞ்சவிஹாரி கௌபி ஜன வல்லவா கிரிவரதாரி கௌபி ஜன வல்லவா கிரிவரதாரி ஜசௌரநந்தன வ்ரஜ ஜனரஞ்சன ஜசௌரநந்தன வ்ரஜ ஜனரஞ்சன ஜமுனாதீராவனச்சாரி ஜமுனாதீரா வனச்சாரி ஜய ராதா மாதவ குஞ்சவிஹாரி ஜய ராதா மாதவ குஞ்சவிஹாரி சாயம் விஷ்ணுபாத் பரமஹம்ச ஸ்ரீ ராஜகாச்சாரிய சத்சி ஸ்ரீமரிசி பக்தி வேதாந்த சாங் ரோவாத் கீஜாய் இஸ்கான் ஃபவுண்டர் ஆச்சாரிய ஸ்ரீ ரோவாத் கீஜாய் சாயம் விஷ்ணுபாத் பரமஹம்ச ஸ்ரீ ராஜகாச்சாரிய சத்சி ஸ்ரீமன் பக்தி சிதாந்த சரஸ்வதி தாக்கூர் கீஜாய் அனந்த கோதி வைஷ்ணவ விருந்த கீஜாய் நாமாச்சாரிய ஸ்ரீ ஹரிதாஸ் தாக்கூர் கீஜாய் பிரேம் சகோ ஸ்ரீ கிருஷ்ண சைதன்ய பிரபு நித்யானந்த ஸ்ரீ தைத ராதா ஸ்ரீவாசாதி கௌர் பக்திருந்த கீஜாய் ஸ்ரீ ஸ்ரீ ராதா கிருஷ்ண கோபிநாத் ஷாம் குந்த ராதா குந்த கிரிகோர்தன் கி ஜாய் பிருந்தாவந்தாம் கி ஜாய் மாயாபுரதாம் கி ஜாய் ஜகநாத் சாமி கி ஜாய் கங்காமயி கி ஜாய் ஜமுனாமயி கி ஜாய் துளசி தேவி கி ஜாய் பக்தி தேவி கி ஜாய் சமவேத பக்திவிருந்த கி ஜாய் ஆல் க்ளோரிஸ் டு தி அசெம்பிள்ட் டிவோட்டீஸ் கௌர் பிரேமானந்தி So, Srimad Bhagavatam 4.8.46, translation and purports by Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tarunam Ramaniya Angam Aruna Oshta Ikshana Adaram Pranata Asayanam Nrimnam Saranyam Karuna Arnavam Tarunam Ramaniyangam Tarunam Ramaniyangam Arunoste Ikshanadaram Arunoste Ikshanadaram Pranatasayanam Rimnam Pranatasayanam Rimnam Saranyam Karunarnavam Saranyam Karunarnavam Tarunam Ramaniyangam Arunoste Ikshanadaram Pranatasayanam Rimnam Saranyam Karunarnavam Sanadaram Vrindasayanam Rimnam Very good. So now Prabhupada's translation. Tarunam means youthful, Ramaniya, attractive, Angam, all parts of the body, Aruna, Oshta, lips pinkish like the rising sun, Ikshana, Adaram, eyes of the same nature, Pranata, one who is surrendered, Asayanam, shelter of the surrendered, Rimnam, transcendentally pleasing in all respects. Sharanyam, the person to whom it is just worthy to surrender. Karuna, merciful like Arnavam, the ocean. Prabhupada's translation. Narada Muni continued, the Lord's form is always youthful. Every limb and every part of his body is properly formed, free from defect. His eyes and lips are pinkish like the rising sun. He is always prepared to give shelter to the surrendered soul. Anyone so fortunate as to look upon him feels all satisfaction. The Lord is always worthy to be the master of the surrendered soul, for he is the ocean of mercy. So Prabhupada's purport, everyone has to surrender to someone superior. Interesting. Often in Prabhupada's purports, the opening statement has an amazing philosophical conclusion. everyone has to surrender to someone superior. This goes very much against the prevailing wishful thinking, especially in this country, that everyone has to become free and not surrender to anyone. But here, Prabhupada gives the fact that everyone has to surrender to someone superior. That is always the nature of our living condition. At the present moment, we are trying to surrender to someone, either to society or to our nation, family, state, or government. So what does this mean? I mean, trying to understand this practically, Prabhupada says that at the present moment, we are trying to surrender. This is a question for the audience. That in America, are people consciously trying to surrender? Or not? Yes, Bunny?
Well, they're trying because they have to try.
Is there a microphone, or is that just come later for the questions? Maybe you could, because I'd like to see what the devotees' realizations are on this point. You're on the air.
They have to try because, according to what Prabhupada said in the first sentence, by their nature, they're subject to surrender to a superior.
But trying means that it's something you're seeking. So just like, for example, the law of gravity. Let's say if someone's slipping down a hill, you could say anyone, like the law of gravity acts on them, but they're not trying to slip down the hill. It's just an inevitable result of the law of gravity. So is there a type of gravity which pulls everyone to surrender to someone superior, even though they're trying to be independent, or people actually trying to surrender? Yes, Priyu.
Trying to surrender in the sense that they're seeking shelter of? Could that be like an aspect of surrender that, you know, you accept authority and you receive shelter?
Yeah, I think we have to. Prabhupada says in his purport to that verse in the Bhagavatam in the first canto, Tadvag Visargo, that he's speaking in a second language. This is not his native language. For example, Prabhupada describes Krishna's eyes as pinkish. And in America, in English, we have the term pink eye, which is not something very... I mean, if you want to know what color Prabhupada means here, the word Aruna means the new sun, the rising sun. So if you just look at the rising sun, it's kind of orangish. Red, orange, pink, whatever color that rising sun is, that's the color that's being described here. Which is not, strictly speaking, a pink color, but yes, back there in the peanut gallery?
No, are you finishing? I'm trying to...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say that in society, everyone is trying to surrender, but they're trying to surrender to their mind and their senses. And they're making a sincere effort to surrender to that. That's why we see everything that's going on in the material world. So people do try to seriously surrender to the mind, what the mind's dictating, because they don't know the difference between the soul and the mind. This whole world is sincerely trying to surrender to the senses and to the mind.
Okay, so let's think about that. If, let's say, I'm in the bodily concept of life, of course, no one would ever suspect me of that. But if I'm in the bodily concept of life, or if I identify with my mind, then, as you say, in surrendering to the mind, I really don't feel like I'm surrendering to someone outside myself. In a sense, I feel like I'm engaged in self-affirmation because I am this material mind. That's my illusion. And so, therefore, I feel that I'm sort of, you know, establishing my autonomy, my strength. I'm strong because I can do what I want. Not recognizing that what I think I want is really just the dictation of the mind.
Well, they say that you are the most important person to yourself.
I mean, you are the most important person. You know, outside of yourself, there's no one more important than you. And they that's their philosophy. So that's why they're surrendering to the mind. Because
no
one's more important than you.
Well, then Prahlad Maharaj says that Nate Vidu Sartha Katingi Vishnu. People don't realize that their actual self-interest is Vishnu. Archie,
Maharaj, I say the key to understanding the sentence is the verb try. In other words, it's not coming naturally. If you go to a job, you don't naturally want to surrender, but you have to try to do it, otherwise you won't have a job. If you're engaged in a relationship, you may not naturally want to surrender to that person, but you have to try, otherwise the relationship won't work out.
But in a job, for example, well, but in a job, I have a boss, and people often don't like their bosses, and yet they have to follow the boss or they'll be fired. And so they're trying to cooperate. But, okay, that's an interesting point. So Prabhupada says, our nature is to surrender to someone superior. We are trying to surrender to someone. I think perhaps what Prabhupada means by that is there, to the extent that we are socialized, we are social creatures, and naturally we fall into patterns of compliance with certain social standards. For example, you stop at the red light, you go at the green light. If you see someone running a light, you kind of are offended by it. There's a sense in which if you're walking down the street or driving your car and you see someone just go through a red light, there's a sense in which the social part of you, the citizen in you, is offended by that. Isn't it? Like, what are you doing? There's a sense in which that person is attacking the law and order, the obedience to the common law, which is the basis of secure life. Everyone's security is somehow threatened by that. Yes.
In the Nectar of Instruction, Prabhupada describes that in devotional service, which means surrender, that one becomes confident. That's simultaneous. That's there. One has to be confident. And Prabhupada describes surrender as being that one has full confidence that Krishna will protect and assist or help in the execution of devotional service. So it appears that in the material world, they're trying to surrender to different personalities that are offering them something in order for them to be confident in their trying to surrender, such as all these gurus out there today that are trying to promote, who am I thinking of? You know, all these great guys that are out there speaking all this great stuff.
Yeah.
How to be confident in life. You can do it.
Oh, yeah, like self-esteem,
yeah,
self-help.
Self-esteem, you can do it. If you surrender to this particular process, if you try, then the result will be that you'll have confidence in yourself to execute and become a really perfect materialist.
Right.
So in the same way, Prabhupada says in active instruction that it also is applicable in the sense that one has to be confident in Krishna that he'll protect him and that he'll help you in the execution of your devotional service.
Very good. So I think this is a good way to summarize it. What Prabhupada means, I believe, when he says everyone has to surrender to someone superior, is that we as individuals are actually in a very precarious situation. Very few people have the resources and energy to actually feed themselves, for example. I mean, if every individual had to feed themselves, had to produce or find or collect all of their own food, all of their own drinking water, and if there was no government, so that, let's say, for example, there were bigger, stronger people who had arrived first at the only available drinking water and threatened you with, it was a credible threat, with bodily harm if you didn't exit, you might actually be in a difficult situation even to find drinking water. And what to speak of food. And when you see situations where law and order breaks down, it's every person for themselves. So it's not difficult to understand that given the nature of this world, it's a very dangerous world. Our health and well-being is very precarious. It can be destroyed very easily in so many ways. So there's a need for law and order. There's a need for human cooperation just to secure the basic necessities of life. There's actually a need for human cooperation. And people, therefore, psychologically, are, you could say, hardwired to cooperate and to follow rules, to follow certain rules of the game. And so to surrender to something is to depend upon it. Like you mentioned the government, and we see that people are, there are all kinds of committees, political action committees, and people writing letters to their Congress people and demanding this and demanding that and depending on or looking to or relying upon. I think this is something of what Prabhupada means by surrender, because as human beings, very, very few human beings, almost no human beings, are in every sense self-reliant, autonomous. Therefore, practically everyone has to cooperate in some way with other people. There have to be rules which govern that cooperation. And people take shelter of or surrender to those specific arrangements, those sets of rules, systems of cooperative behavior and mutual aid and protection. People surrender to those things in order to survive and beyond survival in order to live well. And so when Prabhupada says we are trying to surrender to, I think what he means there is there, as Savas pointed out, they're trying to get the benefits of cooperation and the benefits of legitimate authority and practical organization. They're trying to get the benefits of those things by depending on, as Prabhupada says, nation, family, state, or government. We have, I think some of the possible linguistic confusion here is that when we talk about surrender, it's sort of a sense of, well, with Krishna, selfless surrender. You just give yourself to Krishna and serve Krishna. That's not obviously what people are trying to do. People are not trying to selflessly. Very few people are interested in selflessly giving themselves to country or to family nowadays, actually. Very few people go to family Thanksgiving dinners and declare to the family, I'm giving up all my selfish desires and I'm prepared now to lovingly serve the family. I mean, that doesn't really happen. Or the state, or the government, which most people don't trust. So, therefore, when Prabhupada says surrender, what he means is depend upon a particular institution, community or society in the hope of fulfilling one's own basic needs and desires through that relationship. So I think that's actually what the idea is here. Yes?
I think here Swami talks about all the jiva, if there is starting from the very lower consciousness, which is here, kind of the field, links to the upper, to the humans who are seeking sutra, so their dependency becomes a sutra dependency.
So, you know, dependency is always there until you reach the moksha.
Yes, yeah, of course. Of course, that's the point here. And I guess our discussion has been trying to understand exactly what Prabhupada means by surrender here. Because also, to be perfectly honest, in India, at least during Prabhupada's time, was much more, I think, of a vertical society. There was much, at least coming from traditional Indian culture, the father or the mother or the grandfather, grandmother, or other leaders, there's much more a sense of authority, the guru, offering obeisances. I mean, there's much more a sense in the culture, a culturally positive value attached to submitting to an authority. Whereas, as we know, in the West, it's very different. This has been a difference between Asia in general, and the West for many thousands of years. For many thousands of years, the Asian perception that Western people tend to be kind of crude and rebellious, and the Western perception that Asian people tend to be kind of like, submissive or weak. Yeah, they just kind of submit. That mutual perception you can trace back many thousands of years. For example, that's exactly how the Persians, the Persian Empire went all the way to the doorstep of India. The Persian Empire went all the way, of course, included Iran, which historically, I mean, the ancient Persian language is a dialect of Sanskrit. In fact, the word Hindu is a Persian word, interestingly enough. So So if you look at, say, 2,500 years ago, approximately, or 2,400 years ago, these great battles between the Persian Empire and Greece, and they very much had this perception of each other. And, of course, when Alexander went to Asia, he also it became... So anyway, I say this because here we have the word surrender. In America, people wouldn't speak this way, like, I'm trying to surrender to the government. We wouldn't speak that way. Or I'm trying to surrender to my family. So if we look at what Prabhupada means by surrender, then of course he's making a correct statement. Prabhupada's the philosophical, if you look at the way he's using the word surrender, then it's a correct point. And also Prabhupada is saying that that's what it amounts to. That's what it boils down to. Although, getting back to your point, if you look at the ways in which, let's say, in the highest stage of spiritual consciousness, what it means to surrender, it's very different than the type of utilitarian sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back type of relationship that goes on the material level, where it's just it's sort of a transparent bartering system. Like, okay, I'm going to work for the government, but I expect the government to do certain things. And if the government doesn't do that, it's stated in the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, governments aren't really doing their job, then you overturn them. So there's no question of overturning Krishna. Anyway, the reason I'm getting at this is because Prabhupada once wrote a letter to me and said, you should read my books and then explain them in your own words. Prabhupada definitely expected us to translate his teachings, not only from English into foreign languages, as English speakers call languages besides English, not only from English into foreign languages, but also there's a need for some cultural translation here. Because Prabhupada is using English at times in a way which is not the normal way that people would use it in America. It doesn't mean that American English is the standard or is the right way to use English. It's just the way Americans use English. And so I think we have to be sensitive to this need, which Prabhupada himself clearly recognized and asked us. And Prabhupada personally talked about this need. He talked about it to me, the need to take his teachings and make them understandable to people in this country. And of course that requires, first of all, that we understand what Prabhupada actually means by these things. So, I'll go on. Prabhupada said the surrendering process already exists, but it is never perfect because the person or institution unto whom we surrender, and again in America, I don't think anyone feels they're surrendering to the government. I think they feel it's just like a social contract. In fact, in a contract, when two people enter into a contract, neither one is surrendering to the other, they're just entering into a contract. And the whole Western perception of the basis of authority, the government's authority, is a social contract. In fact, a social contract in which the people themselves are empowering the government. And at least theoretically, although this seldom actually happens in practice, but theoretically, in democratic societies, the people expect the government to surrender to their will. Whereas in India, as in pre-industrial Europe, the notion of authority was that authority comes from God down through certain chosen people, like priests and kings. And so in Sanskrit, you have the common term, epithet, Naradeva, God among men, which is a name for the king. Or Nrideva, or Naradeva, and so on and so forth. Janeshwara, Lord of the people. Respectable people in English, and still in some languages, used to be called Lord. This is a whole different way of thinking about authority. For example, in Spanish, the word Mr. is Señor, which many of you know, and Señor means Lord. So to call someone Señor Garcia which we translate, if you take a Spanish class, you're taught that means Mr. Garcia. What it literally means is Lord Garcia. And in fact, in English, Mr., Meister, in German, is Master, Prabhu. So if you're Mr. Smith, you're Master Smith, and or Prabhu Smith. And even in French, Monsieur is Monseigneur, my Lord. My Lord, Monseigneur. And in Portuguese, just like some of you know, because we are so close to the border, that in Spanish, the word tú is the familiar form, you, and the polite form of you is usted, which is an abbreviation of vuestra merced, thy mercy. And in Portuguese, the polite word for you is o Senhor, the Lord. In other words, if I'm in Brazil or Portugal, and I'm speaking just to any respectable person, I would call him o Senhor, the Lord. How's the Lord doing? So this is a very different kind of culture. Of course, the linguistic evidence I'm giving you now is just remnants of a very different way of thinking. That the old way of thinking is that all authority comes from God, and in society there is a hierarchy. So at least in traditional societies, priests and kings or queens were considered the highest people and therefore closest to God. This is also the Vedic view in a sense, in terms of authority, social authority and political authority. So therefore the power comes from God down through God's representatives and down to the people. The American Revolution, which may or may not have been a great idea, but anyway, the American Revolution changed all that and said, no, the power of God comes down first to the people and then goes back up to the leaders. And so this was a completely different way of thinking about authority. That actually it is, quote unquote, the people who represent God. Now, it is not a coincidence, I should say, that these kinds of views came from countries that rejected or came from intellectuals and thinkers who were not really enthusiastic about the Roman Catholic view of things. The Roman Catholic view was, of course, that there's hierarchy. There's a pope who is perhaps closest to God, then there are cardinals and bishops and so on. The Protestant Revolution, or Reformation, specifically rejected this and said, if you think about like Baptist churches and everything, where, you know, the people themselves, like everyone can speak. You don't have to, your relationship with God is not mediated by some high priest. The people themselves are closest to God. And in France, where you had the sort of like the, a lot of the political and social thinking which led to the American Revolution, the intellectuals were very violently against the church. And so you have this movement to say, no, it's the people who are ultimately the recipients of political authority from God. And it's the people who are closest to God and therefore don't need to have their relationship with God mediated by Brahmins or priests or popes or whatever. In fact, it was extremely controversial in the 1850s and mid-1800s when there was massive Catholic immigration into this country, especially from Italy and Ireland and also Germany. And there was a very, very nasty attitude towards it. The Americans used to call Catholicism popery. And the Pope was seen as the Antichrist because the Pope was the religious equivalent of a king. Just like in America, you know, God helps someone that tries to make himself king. So the Pope was like the king of religion. So in this Protestant and democratic culture that we live in, the notion that we are trying to surrender to the government, that's definitely not the way people would say it here. Again, it's not that Prabhupada's statement is wrong. It's just that English in India, culturally and even in terms of the vocabulary, is not in every way the same language. Even though these books are in English, there is still a need to, and Prabhupada wrote that to me and said, you should do this, you should read my books and then explain them in your words. And so this is an example, I think, of the need for that, to explain philosophically what Prabhupada actually means. So, the surrendering process already exists, but is never perfect because the person or institution unto whom we surrender is imperfect, and our surrender, having so many ulterior motives, is also imperfect. As such, in the material world, no one is worthy to accept anyone's surrender, nor does anyone fully surrender to anyone else unless obliged to do so. But here, the surrendering process is voluntary, and the Lord is worthy to accept the surrender. Now that's also very interesting. In Christianity, for example, or in many forms of Christianity, the surrendering process is, you could say it's voluntary, but you have like a great choice. Do you want to go to heaven or do you want to be burned alive for trillions of years? Well, let me think about that. First of all, the idea of eternal hell is actually an evil theory, because if you, I mean, what if you read the newspaper that some guy in Los Angeles had, let's say, 20 kids, and he gave all his kids a lot of things to do, and a few of his kids were disobedient, didn't do exactly what the father wanted, so the father poured, you know, lighter fluid on them, and then ignited them, and he did it in such a way so they would burn as long as possible. He tried to, in other words, he wanted them to die very soon, and burn them alive. I mean, that person would be considered the most evil monster. I often challenge audiences when I'm speaking to come up with something, an act more evil than torturing your own children forever. And therefore, if some of these Christian views were correct, the only rational conclusion would be that God is the most evil monster ever conceived by human beings. And in Bhagavad Gita, we find that it's not like this fanatical thing where if you don't surrender, if you don't accept Krishna in your heart, you're going to fry for a very long time. In Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna describes the mode of goodness, it doesn't even include him. In other words, Krishna says in the Gita, you can be happy and actually be elevated, go to higher planets, and never even accept him. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Satvat Sanjayate Sukham, from goodness comes happiness. Krishna says, Urdhvaga Chanti Satvasta, those situated in Sattva Gun, Urdhvanga Chanti, they go upward. So you can be elevated, materially happy, live with the angels and all that, and not accept Krishna. He's not the jealous God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is a cosmopolitan, liberal deity. Krishna is not a religious fanatic. God is not a religious fanatic. It's interesting how you do have these religious fanatics in the world who think that God is one of them. So, I mean, think of it. In the middle of Oxford, England, the famous college town, there, right in the middle of the old historic center, there's a monument to three Oxford professors of theology who were burned alive at the stake by the Queen of England, because the professors had gotten their positions when there was a Protestant monarch, and then there was a change, and a Catholic queen came to power, and she didn't want any Protestant theology taught, and they couldn't give it up, because they were, in a sense, not as violent as she was, but philosophically, I think, no less foolish. They believed that they would go to hell forever if they taught Catholic doctrine. And the Queen thought that the students, these professors, would go to hell forever if they believed what the professors were teaching. These were obviously very intuitive people. And so the Queen burned them alive at the stake. I mean, after all, if God is going to burn the unrepentant and the people that joined the wrong church, if God is going to burn them forever, and I just burn them for a half hour, I mean, God, you know, as in heaven, so on earth. I'm walking in the path of the Lord by burning people alive. So, despite all its piety, and despite all of its excellent music and architecture, the point is that there was something, despite all the good things, there is something actually evil. There is something evil in such religions. There is something evil in it, actually. I mean, to burn people alive is evil, especially because they have slightly different views on certain philosophical matters. To burn them alive is evil. To think that God would torture in the most hideous way his own children forever because in the relatively tiny window of opportunity they were given to join the right church, they didn't make that curve, and there's no question of a second chance, there's no second chance, you're just going to be put in the divine skillet and you are going to be fried forever. And God's intention is not to save you or to rectify you. Because there's no second chance. It's not even some brutal, incredibly tough love to get you to the right point. No. God has absolutely no further interest in ever saving you again. He only wants you to suffer forever. That is evil. That idea is actually evil. And frankly, a lot of the anti-religious sentiment, the fact that a large number of educated people in this country have a somewhat negative view of organized religion, obviously has to be traced to this evil, this monstrous perversion of religion. And in the Old Testament, there are certain passages where certain people who, you know, thought they were prophets inform the people that God is speaking through them that now God wants genocide to be carried out. Like all the worshippers of Baal, who is like some kind of demigod or local nature god in Palestine. So anyone who worships that god, the men, women, and children all have to be murdered, and God will be very displeased if any even women or children are spared. In other words, genocide. So you have now this tradition, for all of its good points, and there are good points, but this tradition where God orders genocide, where God tortures his own children forever if they make one mistake, this monstrous evil comes from a certain part of the world, which is the Middle East. And there's a real sense in which now Western people, especially those from European background, are going back to their original religion, which is Vedic, because all the European languages, practically, with very, very few exceptions, are related to Sanskrit. There is an Indo-European culture originally. And so actually the Vedas are the original religion of Europe. In fact, if you look at pre-Christian Europe, it was very much like Vedic culture in some ways. Of course, you know, it was a little barbaric. They put their own little barbaric twist on it. But in many ways, it was more like Vedic culture. And so, actually, Prabhupada is reuniting the Indo-European family by bringing Vedic culture back to America. It reminds me, there's a funny story in Greece, the movement. Those people can get a little excited at times. And there was a time when every time someone joined the movement, it was a national scandal, and the family would go crazy and take us to court. And it was like every time like some kid would join the movement in Greece. And so, anyway, the devotees were involved in one of those lawsuits where it's like Socrates was, eventually executed on the charge of corrupting the youth of Athens. So this is a very old thing in Greece. Anyway, so at one point the devotees were in court. And it's interesting, it was exactly the same charge that was brought against Socrates, and that is not accepting the religion of the state, and corrupting the youth. It's amazing. The exact same charge was brought against Socrates. And so they were accused of not accepting the religion of Greece, which was, of course, the Greek Orthodox Church. That's changing now a little bit because they're part of the European Union. Anyway, so the boys brought in this witness, this professor, this Greek professor, and he said, actually, it's all of you, pointing to the accusers. It's you who don't accept the religion of Greece. The religion of Greece, he said, is not Christianity. So they said, well, what is it? And the guy said, and he really meant it, he said, I worship Zeus. But it's interesting how the Western Europeans and Americans have sort of like, some of them have embraced so tightly this Middle Eastern thing. By the way, the word Zeus, of course, Latin Deus, from Sanskrit Deva. Jupiter, by the way, is Sanskrit. Do you know? Dew means heaven in Sanskrit, and Peter is father. Dew Peter, father of heaven. Anyway, so there it is. Krishna consciousness. Let me just finish this purport. I know we're over time, and I know I can't compete forever with breakfast. So, this surrender by the living entity occurs automatically as soon as one sees, as soon as the living entity sees the beautiful, youthful nature of the Lord. The description given by Narada Muni is not imaginary. The form of the Lord is understood by the Parampara system. Mayavadi philosophers say that we have to imagine the form of the Lord, but here Narada Muni does not say that. Rather, he gives the description of the Lord from authoritative sources. He, Narada, is himself an authority, and he is able to go to Vaikuntha Loka, spiritual world, and see the Lord personally. Therefore, his description of the bodily features of the Lord is not imagination. Sometimes we give instructions to our students about the bodily features of the Lord, and they paint him. Their paintings are not imaginary. The description is given through the cyclic succession, just like that given by Narada Muni, who sees the Lord and describes his bodily features. Therefore, such descriptions should be accepted, and if they are painted, that is not imaginative painting. So, Prabhupada Ki Jai. We'll stop here. Hari Bol.
Thank you.